What's up, everybody? Welcome to the Squanch, Wisecrack's Rick and Morty podcast. My name is Jared, and I'm joined here with the Squanchers. And for the first time this season, we've got them all together. We've got Ryan.
Jared, you son of a bitch. I'm in.
I knew you were going to do that. And Alec. Alec, did he just steal what you were going to do, too?
Fucking absolutely. But I got a backup plan if you want to introduce me.
And we got Alec.
Hey, nice to be here. This is actually a double cross because this is a Funhouse podcast that you thought was a Wisecrack Rick and Morty podcast.
What?
Ooh.
What? Oh my God. I'm here from Funhouse now? That's crazy.
That's right. You were working and you didn't even know it, Ryan. But anyway, today we're talking about Rick and Morty season 4, episode 3, One Crew Over the Crew Coos Morty. As always, we're going to go around and get first impressions. Ryan, what'd you think of this episode?
Dude, I have to say, I love this episode. I think, I mean, A+ for me. It definitely, I think, hinges on how familiar you are with heist movies, obviously, because it is so much about heist movies and deconstructing heist movies. Luckily, I loved heist movies, and I do love them actively, and I've seen a shit ton of them, so I was definitely on, I was right at the edge of my seat with what they were doing and really into it. We got a little, and then they even double crossed me, man, because they set me up thinking I was watching Ocean's 12, but I was watching Inception.
Mm.
You guys picked that up at the end. I mean, so what a really good heist all around. You can tell they love heist movies. I love the heist con. I loved all the Netflix stuff. It was hilarious. You can really tell. I think that came from their real life. Probably it was probably a meta thing of they probably do have a shit ton of friends who have a lot of deals with Netflix. So I think that was cool. The whole, they seem to be doing the whole kind of commenting on their adventures almost every episode. It's like, well, Morty, you wanted a classic adventure, you know, this time, but look what we're doing now. And at first I'm kind of like, all right, this again, but I think that it's a cool running theme is kind of the meta angle, especially for this show. The hardest I've laughed in forever on Rick and Morty was when they all had to do was when Randotron got involved and they all had to just do random stuff like play in the snow and make weird body movements and scoot around on their asses. That was great. But yeah, my only other critique I'd say is that I also kind of thought that it kind of like I said in episode one, like sometimes I think Rick and Morty can kind of become almost too dense for its own good. Where like I'm like. It's like it's so fast. It's almost impossible to keep up with the first time. And I kind of thought that was going on at this episode, but then it kind of became the convolution kind of was a big part of the plot at the end of the day, you know, because it's commenting on how convoluted these double crosses can get. So at the end, I give them a pass and it kind of worked in their benefit at the end of the day. So overall, love this episode. I love the image of Rick towing Earth at the end behind a ship. Great episode. What y'all think?
Yeah, well, I'd say one of the reasons it probably feels a lot of less dense is this is the first episode this season that has no B plot. It's all A plot.
Mm.
That's true. I didn't even think about that.
Yeah.
Yeah.
But Alec, yeah, what'd you think?
I really liked it. I'm going to go with like an A-. And I think it might possibly because I'm definitely familiar with like Ocean's 11 and appreciate those jokes and a few other things. But maybe I think a larger familiarity would have made me love it even more. But I really liked it. I love the thing at the end where Morty is pitching his heist movie and slowly gets disillusioned as he's talking. I thought that was
accepted.
Yeah, it was a really amazing scene. The other thing that I kind of liked about it is that we talked about this in a video, I think, about Key and Peele, in that there is a kind of like comedic sketch where you have a premise and it just keeps escalating and getting more and more and more and more absurd. And I'm sure Rick and Morty's always doing elements of that, but I felt like that was really shining more than like a traditional plot structure. Like I'm sure all of that's there, but it was just how many levels of heist shit can we keep incepting?
Yeah, absolutely. I think this is probably my least favorite episode of the season thus far, but having said that, I still give it like an A-. It would go episode 1A, episode 2 A+, perhaps A++.
You love the C1. That
I
much,
love
huh?
the C1. Yeah, actually, I was going to ask the next thing. What did you think about that one since you were not here last time?
Disappointed. I was surprised you loved it as much as you did.
Oh, really?
The laughs were very few and far between. It was one of those things where it was like, I liked the germ of the idea. Like, yeah, shy poopers. You know, maybe it's just because you're a shy pooper, Jared, that you relate to it more. But But I don't know. I'm only moderately laughed every once in a while. And I don't know why.
Okay. But yeah, I still like this episode a lot. I don't think I'm super well-versed in heist movies. I've seen your Ocean's 11. Unfortunately, I've seen Ocean's 12. I've seen Inception. I've seen The Sting. Love that movie. And I think I get enough of it. I don't think that you really do have to have a masterful knowledge of heist movies to get what they're going for, because really they're only deconstructing two or three tropes, which we'll get into. Yeah. But I did appreciate that the episode was just doubling down hard on one simple premise, which just seemed to be that somebody in the writer's room really was tired of heist movies, which is also interesting because it's not like there were a bunch that came out this year. I can't think of any. Can you guys?
Yeah, Ocean's 8.
That was last year.
I thought that was this year. Okay.
Well, I think one interesting thing, and I think they kind of allude to this, is that the heist, like a lot of films have caper elements or heist elements without actually being that. And I think you could argue that Avengers Endgame is kind of like that, where they've got to steal these gemstones. And I thought that's what the Hephaestus was about in that episode, because he's making this weapon. It just reminded me of the scene in Infinity War where there's somebody smithing something. But yeah, a lot of movies where there's a MacGuffin where they got to get something and assemble a team. There's a lot of Fast and Furious 6, which is not recent, is also kind of like this. I wouldn't be surprised if some of the more recent ones are also like this. So I think they're still everywhere.
Yeah. How many specific references to movies did you guys pull? Because for me, it was all just vaguely Ocean's 11-esque, but nothing too specific was I able to figure out.
It was vaguely Ocean's 11-esque and then Inception, I thought. But yeah. I don't think that they're necessarily saying, oh, heist movies are everywhere. We're inundated with heist movies. I think it's more just, it's almost like a writing exercise, and the fact that you know, Rick and Morty is known for some of their twists and good writing and stuff. And then they probably were just like wanting to do one of those twists within twists. Obviously, that's best suited for the heist genre. So then they had to make up some bullshit plot to make Rick like hate the heist genre be so ahead of it because he's so smart. I think it's more of a plot element than commentary, you know?
Yeah, maybe they tried to create a badass heist episode, and by the time they were on draft 11 or something like that, realized, man, fuck this. This actually isn't turning out so well. You know what? Maybe there are no good heist narratives. Maybe as Randotron or Heistatron, whoever it is at the end, says at the end, the best heist is the one that's never written. So maybe it was just a reflection of them failing to come to execute on a heist script to their own standards and just deciding to make fun of it.
I don't even think that they're saying that heist movies are all bad. I think that they're more commenting that Rick is just so smart. And that heist movies are all, you know, it's all about the twistiness, all about the good writing, all about how smart the double crosses are. But Rick is just so ahead of the game that heist movies are boring as hell to him.
Oh, see, know? I think they're saying the writing is not good.
Either that or just writers in general. If you're a writer and you think a lot about structure, you're probably watching this movie thinking, all right, no matter what happens, I know that it's probably going to be contextualized within the logic of the protagonist. The protagonist
but
is always going to have had
some.
Does
that make you not like it, or does that just make you, it's just transparent how it's made?
That's why I was saying I haven't seen a heist movie in a couple of years, at least in theaters. I actually never saw Ocean's 8. So, no, I mean, I still love The Sting.
Yeah.
So, does it make me not like it? I guess not.
Logan Lucky was one that came out recently.
Yeah, I didn't
see
that.
Also by Soderbergh.
The joke that made me, it's a reference to Ocean's 11, or I don't know which number it was, but 60% is explaining the heist and 40% is learning that the heist already happened. That's one of the Ocean's movies, right?
Well, it's 60% is assembling the crew.
Right. And 40% is figuring out the heist already happened because there was that plot about, there was like a safe and video cameras, but it was already recorded and they had already stole the thing. And so that was like the one overt reference I got.
Mm. I also got some Reservoir Dogs vibes, like whenever Randotron had come in, you know, because in Reservoir Dogs, obviously, they don't know each other. They're all given colors so that they can't double cross each other, basically, or know who each other are. And I don't know if they were specifically going for that, but I kind of got that vibe.
Mm, interesting. All right, guys, let's go into a recap. When Rick is upstaged by heist artist Miles Knightley, he and Morty seek him out at HeistCon, which will serve as great inspiration for the heist movie that Morty is writing. But in order to get professional badges, they'll first have to put a crew together. After assembling a crew and gaining admission, Miles challenges Rick to steal a crystal skull in a heist-off. Rick's crew defects to Miles and steals the skull, but turns out it was all orchestrated by a robot Rick created called Heistatron, and Rick is in possession of the skull. With Heistatron's help, Rick recruits the entire convention and brings it crashing to the ground. But Heistatron goes rogue, and Rick and Morty have precious time before Heistatron assembles all of existence into a meaningless crew. But in order to stop him, Rick is going to have to assemble a crew. So Rick recruits Mr. Poopy Butthole, Hephaestus, Ventrilo Quiver, and Elon Tusk, while Heistatron heists entire planets with little subtlety. But in order to make sure his plan isn't just a part of Heistatron's greater plan, Rick decides to take orders from Randotron to make sure that their plan evades predictability. Thing is, their world has already been heisted. So Randotron kicks things into random mode, and Rick approaches Heistatron, who, three reveals later, reveals that he is also Randotron. After 2 hours of back-and-forth reveals between Rick and Heistatron, Heistatron concedes to understanding the algorithm that controls him and self-destructs. Morty takes a meeting at Netflix to pitch his heist script, but despite the Netflix exec's excitement at the idea, Morty is exhausted by the contrived nature of heist movies and walks out of the meeting. In the end, it's revealed that the whole episode was an elaborate plan by Rick to heist Morty's enthusiasm for his screenplay so that he'll stop skipping out on adventuring with him. In the post-credits scene, Rick apologizes for training Mr. Poopy Butthole's grad class to attack him. End of episode. All right, guys, before we go on, want to give a shout out to our sponsors over at Manscaped.com. Manscaped.com is the only men's brand dedicated to below-the-waist grooming and hygiene. So, guys, we're all men on this podcast.
That's right.
Tell me, have you ever engaged or have you ever encountered difficulties shaving down there?
Hell yeah.
Go on.
I'll let my statement speak for itself, Jared.
Alec, you're a hairy man. How about you?
Yeah, if I were on camera, not that I'd show you anything inappropriate, but, you know, I think my beard is indicative of generally what's going on in my life. I'll keep it that vague.
Thank you. And so, yeah, challenges?
Yeah, you know, you need a tool to keep it down there so it's not like some overgrown forest that's full of dangers and mysteries. That's bad. You shouldn't do that. It also seems unhygienic, you know, big into germophobia.
Yes, Alec is a huge germaphobe, which, by the way, last time on the podcast when you told me that you would go to vacant bathrooms at your university, I didn't even call you out on how weird that was, but I'm doing it right now. But anyway, Manscaped has the perfect package 2.0 kit, which includes the Lawnmower 2.0 electric trimmer. This is a full body trimmer, so you don't only have to use it down there, and it's 100% waterproof and cordless, so it's perfect for trimming in the shower and is built with skin safe technology. So also, when you purchase the Perfect Package 2.0, you'll get two free gifts. You'll get a cool pair of boxers, plus a luxury all-leather shed travel bag. You can get 20% off, plus free shipping and your two free gifts with the code WISECRACK20 at manscaped.com. Also, Manscaped recently partnered up with the Testicular Cancer Society as part of their We Save Balls initiative, so you can feel good knowing that your purchase today is going to a charitable cause. So once again, that's manscaped.com, 20% off, plus free shipping, plus two free gifts with the code WISECRACK20. Ladies, get it for your man. Man, get it for your ladies. Be, you know, wary that they have to deal with this shit. Anyway, and back to the show. All right, guys. So let's talk about deconstructing the heist movie. So obviously,
let's do it, baby.
Yeah. Obviously, the first thing is that they're formulaic because Rick is able to create an algorithm based on two heist movies that he slept through and, to quote him, use it to automate a joyless process you call art. So you're saying that you don't think they're saying that heist movies are poorly written, Ryan?
No, I think that they're that. I mean, Rick would say that because he's a cynical bastard. But, you know, like, because Rick doesn't get the joy out of anything. Anything that people like, he's going to find the way. He's going to deconstruct it inherently and be like, all right, this is why people like it, and you're stupid for liking it. So I don't take what Rick says as gospel, you know, for how the writers believe, you know. But I do think that as really good writers, they see heist movies as formulaic, yes. But that doesn't mean that they don't think that they're cool.
Yeah, I can see that. So let's talk about the first trope that they deconstruct, the crew assembly. This is basically the whole episode. Of course, I mean, the funniest times in the episode to me, the times I laughed the most were whenever somebody said, "You son of a bitch, I'm in."
That was great.
Is that any particular movie that has that line, or is it just a general tone that we see during those scenes in movies?
You know, I think it's generally a trope. I was recently watching The Boys, which is a great show. It's not a caper thing or a heist thing, but it makes fun of superhero movies, but it involves assembling a crew, The Boys, and it's three people. And there's just like a moment where there's like an old sort of business associate that they need to get in their crew. And there was a falling out. So they had to, you know, get him back in. And they never said, "You son of a bitch, I'm in." But it's essentially like, "You're a son of a bitch. Oh, fuck, I guess I'm in." And I feel like that also applies at various points to various Fast and Furious movies. Someone had a falling out, but the heist is so good that they got to get back in the game. And so the sentiment there is, again, "You son of a bitch, I'm in."
Yeah, it's all about making it a frenemy type thing, because the frenemy is more complex, more fun than it just being two people reuniting that are really on good terms.
Yeah. I don't think that it is a very specific film. If it is, commenters, please tell us. I'd love to know. But it's also something that I feel like isn't even it's in pop culture, like not just in heist movies. Like if a character sees somebody they haven't seen for a long time saying, "Oh, you son of a bitch," like that just seems it's perfectly generic is what I would say. Like, I don't know what it's from, but it just sounds like something you've heard and seen a million times and you don't know where, like we're saying right now, but it just fits so perfectly. I can't believe it.
Well, there's also that increased intimacy with, if you're comfortable enough to call somebody a son of a bitch, obviously you guys have been through the ringer together. You guys have been through a lot. You guys know each other so well that you can basically insult them. And so it's just a really quick way to establish that these people have history together, because they can call them a son of a bitch lovingly.
And then and then just flipping it immediately two words later by saying, "I'm in." Like, no matter what the context of you being here is, "You son of a bitch, we've been through some shit. But whatever it is, I'm in. Let's do it."
Yeah.
It's so absurd and funny.
Yeah, I was just going to say, I think it's up in the air whether the "you son of a bitch" is like, "I'm the reluctant ally and you're a son of a bitch," or "I've known you so long and we love each other, you son of a bitch," you know?
Mm-hmm. I think it's the second. I think it's the playful, like, "Oh, I've been here before. I know what you're up to. When you come around, it's because we got a heist going on, you son of a bitch. Right. Let's do it. I'm in."
Yeah. So there's a part where Rick says, "I hate heist movies and the crew assemblies are the worst part." And then Morty says, "How are we going to stop it?" He says, "With a little help from some old friends," and then cut to commercial. That was so good. I guess my question to you guys is, do you think that this episode is good or is engaging to watch for the same reasons that a heist movie is engaging to watch, or is it totally different? Oh, we say have a yes and a no.
You want to go first, Ryan?
I mean, kind of for what I said before, like it's really fun and engaging to watch, but yeah, if you were to break it down and, you know, beat by beat and really look at the script, you could probably see like, oh, I can see all the setups, but I had a blast watching this one. Why did you not?
But it's not tense, right? Heist movies are often very tense. And I think, at least in the later acts, perhaps the assembling the crew thing has that same fun energy that we come to expect from an Ocean's 11 or an Inception. But in terms of really blowing our minds with the reveals, I don't think it really operates on that level.
You mean the episode does?
The episode.
Does not?
Well, actually, maybe not. I think the final reveal that Rick is doing that, or doing this whole thing just to make sure that Morty stops writing his screenplay, that was a fulfilling reveal, but there were literally tens of reveals before that that were just the butt of a joke and never was a huge paradigm shift or anything.
If you're asking me if this episode blew my mind, the answer is not really.
Right.
Right. Like, I think that it's funny because the double turns and the twists become so... I was actually wondering if I should try to map this out on a piece of paper, but I said, fuck it. But I think it's up in the air if it would actually make any sense when you did map it out. But I think the point is still the pacing of it is it's literally impossible to follow. Like I could vaguely say there was a thing about Randotron and the random one and the heist one getting switched, but I couldn't tell you like in what order or how. Were they actually all foreshadowed or were they like fake callbacks? I mean, certainly like Morty writing the script was in a scene earlier, but like that's the other thing. Do you think there's a, like, and I think this is the part of the joke about maybe calling heist movies bad screenwriting, is there at some point there's like a fine line between like a twist and a deus ex machina. And, you know, I think one of those things is obviously foreshadowing, right? Like you set up the twist before it happens and then you can rewatch it and be like, oh, holy shit, like I should have known this all along. But my question is that always true? Like, you know, they might put something in the background that would technically foreshadow it, but was just a lazy way to justify it after the fact. Does that make sense?
Yeah, well, that's a badly written one. I mean, the reason that setup or the big setup, the character gathering for heist movies is such 60% of it is just because that's where all the setup is. That's where you, and then you know, usually it's the very final act where you're watching them actually pull off the heist, where it's the payoff, like the killing. Have you guys seen the killing?
Oh no.
Yeah.
I mean, that's like, you know, the whole movie it's set up and payoff. So, I mean, that's kind of what the structure is for these things. And the cool part about why I love this episode so much is that, it's not like you're so invested in the structure that you're really following it like a heist movie. It's, you know, that they're just pulling that they're going, the crisscrosses and double crosses are so going to be so absurd that every single one, you're like, all right, what are they going to think of to double, you know, to deconstruct this and to reverse it? And that's what was so funny. And then the fact that they all made sense and were actually logical, you know, to a degree, was great. Mm. It was just it was well written. It was more, I was impressed. And while I was laughing, then I was just like, whoa, I can't believe that they set that up earlier.
Mm. Well, by the time it's Heistatron saying that he's also Randotron, that's when it started breaking down and not making sense to me. In terms of at the end, when we say, oh, it was all part of Rick's plan, I agree that that's really fulfilling, but I couldn't tell you what the plan is, because the whole thing with him building two computers, switching them, they switch it back, then he relabels them, and then turns out that Randotron actually has a Heistatron chip in him, so he was both Heistatron and Randotron the whole time. I don't even know if I'm getting this right by saying it right now.
It's straight up that scene from The Princess Bride where he poisons one of the shot glasses, and then he's like deconstructing his thought process. Like, well, if you thought that I was going to do this, I would do this. It's like a never ending riddle that you could go on for forever, and they're playing with that concept. And so, they're probably at the end. I would be very curious if you actually wrote down what they were saying and wrote a graph, what it all ended up being. But I think that there's no real answer. It's just a joke.
I think this brings us to the second trope. The trope is the constant reveals. So there are 9+ reveals that occur in this episode. And just like Morty says in the pitch meeting with Netflix, all of them are part of the hero's greater plan. So just to name a couple of them, Rick's crew is co-opted by Miles, but then Miles' skull heist is co-opted by Heistatron. Then Rick's plan is co-opted by Heistatron when it's revealed that the planet has already been heisted. But this one's a maybe, because I guess we're supposed to believe at the end that Rick was always in control. Then Rick's creating of Randotron is co-opted by Heistatron. Again, maybe. Heistatron believing he programmed Rick was programmed by Rick in an algorithm that iterates on this 100 times, if not thousands of times. And what do you guys think about the last line that Randotron or Heistatron says? It appears that the perfect heist is the one that was never written.
I think they hate heist movies, and I think this is where I disagree with Ryan.
That is actually where my brain exploded and I stopped following it a little bit.
because I think that like they make this insane convoluted logic that is not actually logical. And I think when Morty explains it, like, and then there's a double cross, but actually the double cross is all known. I think that they're saying that heist movies are bad and should stop existing. I don't know. It seems like that's what they're saying.
It seemed to me just like a cynical punchline to a joke. It's like, oh my God, not only is Rick the smartest person and he thinks that heist movies are stupid and suck, but this computer, this super smart artificial intelligent computer, came to the final conclusion that heist movies suck too. So he was right all along, and it vindicated him.
Yeah.
You know, what I really like about this episode is that all of this craziness is couched in a very simple character beat, that Rick misses Morty and wants him to join him on adventures.
Oh,
yeah.
And I think that this is something that's consistently happening in this season. There's very elaborate sci-fi plots that speak to very simple character beats. Like in episode one, Rick's life with his family, he learns, isn't that bad. He starts off complaining, then he sees what family life is like when you're a wasp, or worst, in a fascist dystopia. And when he's with the wasp family and they're eating Mr. Goldenfold, he says, hey, this isn't so bad. And then episode two, you know, this whole thing with shy pooping, Rick has to hide from his emotions, which makes his loneliness self-imposed. That's what he realizes, his loneliness is self-imposed. And then episode three, we just learn that he needs Morty. And that ultimately, I think that's the really important thing that we take away from these episodes. And yeah, I actually quite like that.
Yeah, that Rick needs Morty. That's what we should always be thinking.
All right, guys, before we move on, I want to give a shout out to another one of our sponsors over at Skillshare. Skillshare is an online learning community with thousands of amazing classes covering dozens of creative and entrepreneurial skills. You can take classes in everything from photography and creative writing to design, productivity, and more. So whether you're returning to a longtime passion project, challenging yourself to get outside of your comfort zone, or simply enjoying something new, Skillshare has got classes for you. I want to talk about a class. If you guys are fans of the movie Adaptation, I know that we certainly are. It's a Nicolas Cage movie. But yeah, if you remember in that movie, the book The Orchid Thief that Charlie Kaufman's character is trying to adapt is written by Susan Orlean. And there is a class on Skillshare. Say again?
I said my mind is blown because I've been talking about the Susan Orlean class, and I know I didn't know her from Adaptation. I just knew her from other things.
Oh, yeah. Yeah. Anyway, Susan Orlean has a class called Creative Nonfiction, Writing Truth with Style. Have you taken this one, Alec?
Yeah. No, I really liked it. And I do a Skillshare ad for other podcasts, I'm talking about it.
Oh, cool. I didn't even realize that. Yeah. What are some of your favorite things? I mean, I really like her lesson on turning your subject into a story, because that's something that we often have to do at Wisecrack, is basically take some sort of an idea or an angle on a piece of media and basically take that and turn it into some kind of a narrative with three acts so we know where we're going with the story. But what about you?
Kind of similar, but yeah, she talks through the process. I forget what it was. It was like an 11-year-old kid in Long Island or something. And just turning this thing, which is a very difficult subject, into like a whole very long form story. And I think just the process of going through that and learning how she did it is like immensely valuable for writers, because whether it's an 11-year-old or like an obscure philosophy text, it's all so, so important to understand how to take a subject and expand it out.
Yeah.
In the class, does she discuss at all how or why she decided to murder Nick Cage and do drugs with Chris Cooper?
I wish she did. I wish there was a Q&A. I would ask her that. But anyway, yeah, creative nonfiction. I think that's also what you could describe what we do as. So if you guys are interested in writing stuff like Susan does or like we do, I really recommend that class. You can join the millions of students already learning on Skillshare today with a special offer just for our listeners, 2 free months. That's right. Skillshare is offering Squanch listeners 2 free months of unlimited access to thousands of classes for free. To sign up, go to Skillshare.com/wisecrack. Again, Skillshare.com/wisecrack to get 2 free months now. And once again, that's Skillshare.com/wisecrack. And now back to the show. I mean, that deconstructing the heist movie thing is pretty much the whole episode, but there are some good jokes that I want to go through, unless you wanted to say anything else about heist movies, gentlemen.
I have a thing to say, which is last episode, there was clearly some references to Fast and Furious with the character living their life at a quarter mile at a time. And then this movie, I think, has a lot of overlap with the heist elements of certain Fast and Furious movies. So what I'm really saying is this entire season is an ode to the Fast and Furious franchise. That's all I'm going to say.
I buy it.
Okay. Did you have anything to say about that, Jared?
Oh, just that I definitely 110,000% buy it.
Okay, yeah, me too. I was going to say 20,000, but we were right around there. The only other thing I was going to say is that we were talking about specific movies this thing was parodying, and we mentioned the Ocean movies, but it literally is the style that Soderbergh edits and shot the Oceans movies in, and I'm specifically talking about all the split screens, you know. So which really, it's not like every heist movie is full of split screens. That's kind of a Soderbergh thing. So I do think that this was a pretty much one-to-one on the Oceans movies, you know, whether it's about the gathering of the characters or just how it literally is filmed and cut together.
Good point. All right, so we got to go through one joke here that, got to be honest, triggered me a little bit.
Can I guess what it is?
You already know what it is.
It's David Lynch.
It is. Yeah.
Oh, yeah. I forgot about that.
So when Rick is creating Randotron, he says, instead of two heist movies I slept through, Randotron's algorithm is derived from the plot of three David Lynch movies I pretended to like to make my friends shut up.
And you're the friend. And I mean, you haven't made me watch any David Lynch movies.
No, I don't really push it upon people because it's a taste thing. Not everyone is going to like it. But then Mr. Poopy Butthole says, I don't really get it, but it sounds like that's the point, which is which is the proper answer after watching any David Lynch movie.
What are some David Lynch movies?
Wild at Heart, Blue Velvet, Mulholland Drive, Lost Highway, Eraserhead.
I knew Twin Peaks.
Yeah, Eraserhead. Dune.
Inland Empire. Don't pull Dune. Fuck Dune.
I'm just naming every David Lynch movie I can think of.
Yeah. I think we maybe got them all.
I think we said all of them.
There's not a ton of them.
You said Mulholland Drive, right?
Yeah, I said Mulholland Drive. All right, well, since we're on this topic, I already know.
Fire Walk with Me,
yes, good. I already know your favorite, but for the audience, what's your favorite David Lynch movie, Ryan?
Wild at Heart, baby. Yeah.
Nicolas Cage. Alec, you got to see that one. That's where Nicolas Cage is in his snakeskin jacket.
Oh, shit.
This snakeskin jacket is a symbol of my individuality and my belief in personal freedom.
Yeah. Yeah, maybe amazing. I should watch it tonight, to be honest. I was going to watch some more Fast and Furious movies, but this sounds better.
No.
Another thing in this episode that I think is great in this episode, but is also something that I mentioned in the last two episodes, is the visual comedy. The anti-booby suits are pretty awesome when they're just walking through the booby-trapped laden temple and everything is just bouncing off them. So far, that's my favorite part of this season is these visual jokes. Some of them are so clever, like when Ventrilla Quiver shoots arrows that carry her voice. She shoots Rick and then her voice comes through Rick. Mr. Poopy Butthole killing his grad students was freaking epic. It was very reminiscent of episode 2 Yoda in this man of small, or whatever he is, of small stature, kicking some major ass.
Right.
Another great joke. Oh, wow. A signing with Catherine's Alpha through Omega Joneses, which is probably a reference to Entrapment, another heist movie that I don't think it has split screen like Ryan talked about, but it definitely has the assembling a crew and that you son of a bitch kind of energy.
Wait, can you explain that to me? I didn't get that joke.
Because Catherine Zeta Jones is her name.
Oh,
so
yeah.
It's a great joke because it works on two levels. It's making fun of her name, but also it's a multiverse thing. So there would be a Catherine Alpha Jones, Beta Jones, Zeta Jones, Omega Jones.
That's great. Love that. Love this joke.
Dude, I got to say, I did not even get that until you just explained that. Thank you, Jared.
There you go.
I learned something today.
Unless, there's not another Catherine Zeta-Jones heist movie that I'm forgetting, is there? It's probably Entrapment, right?
Yeah, it's Sean Connery and her in Entrapment. That's the only one. Oh, no, Out of Sight. Oh, no, that's J-Lo. Fuck.
Yeah,
or is that?
Is she in a movie
with Jennifer Lopez and George Clooney. Sorry, what did you ask, Alec?
Is she in a movie with Brendan Fraser? That's also maybe a heist movie? No.
I don't know.
A Brendan Fraser heist movie?
Well, no. Okay. I think I just remember seeing the movie Bedazzled and didn't really remember what it was about.
I love Bedazzled.
Oh, no. That's not a heist movie.
Okay.
That's not a heist movie. That's a devil movie.
Okay.
Yeah. I also love that one of Miles's crew is Double Microwave, which is just two microwaves stacked on. Yeah, definitely my favorite character of the episode, too. That was pretty awesome.
And he microwaved some metal to create a diversion in one of the heist flashbacks or whatever you would call
it. Yeah. During one of the Soderbergh sequences.
Oh,
one thing we haven't brought up yet is Elon Musk voicing himself. What'd you guys think of that?
Oh, yeah. That took me a second to go, wait, is that him? And it was him.
Because they were making fun of him. And I was like, would Elon Musk sign up for that? And I guess the answer is yes.
Wait, how were they making fun of him?
They were just saying, like, see, this is your controlling bullshit. And this is why, you know, we had to get Elon Tusk instead of Elon Musk.
Oh, man, that's not a real criticism.
Yeah,
that's like one of those flattering criticisms of like, oh, I'm such a genius. Sometimes I can be so controlling.
Yeah, it's not like you made a stupid car that nobody likes.
I did see on like Know Your Meme or something them break down. Apparently, the Elon Musk thing is a meme already. Like there was some Twitter thing where people were taking Elon Musk's names and kind of making multiverse versions of him, like just elongating it in weird ways and stuff. And so then Elon Musk changed his Twitter avatar to Elon Musk for a while or for a day or two. And so then that happened. And then I guess somehow that made it into the multiverse of Rick and Morty, because I guess he's also a Rick and Morty fan as well.
Hmm.
Yeah, I'd seen him tweet about Rick and Morty before.
Yeah.
There's one joke that does not make sense to me. And I listened, and I at first I thought maybe I heard it wrong, but I listened to it like four times, and I'm pretty certain that it just is wrong. So at the very beginning, Rick and Morty are at the temple, and right before they're about to raid the tomb, Rick says, "If you want to take a beat and acknowledge the sacred atmosphere, it might give this cynical grave robbing a hint of irreverence." Shouldn't it be reverence? Because the cynical grave robbing is already irreverent. And I was like, okay, maybe I'm just hearing this wrong. But I listened to it four times and he definitely says irreverence.
Maybe the joke is that for Rick and Morty comedic sake, they would want it to be irreverent.
But it's already cynical grave robbing. How more irreverent can you be?
Well, because cynical grave robbing is not necessarily irreverent. But for a guy to be like, don't you just love like, you know, this ode to like not humanity, but like craftsmanship or something. It's like, great, let's steal it, you know?
No, but if you're acknowledging the sacred atmosphere, that would be reverent, not irreverent.
But you're doing it literally in the middle of robbing it. So you're just like,
that would be irreverent.
How you're like, this is more irreverent to look around going, wow, look how glorious this place is.
All right,
is
you guys write in. Tell me who you agree with, because I think that it's already irreverent to desecrate a grave. So it's just redundant if that's the case.
Right. I think he's trying to point out how irreverent they're being, and that he wants to have it be even more irreverent. But I agree with you that it is.
But he says it might give it a hint of irreverence. There's already a whole shit ton of irreverence there, so it's not really adding a hint.
I think he's being sarcastic.
It's a weird joke. Even if I were to buy that it's a weird joke, and part of me thinks I would say there's a 10% chance that it was a mistake.
Okay.
10%. Hey, you know, it's not very much.
All right. Yeah.
All right. We're going to go into the mailbag. Hit us up at 213-534-8807 with voicemails. We're going to go with one from Anonymous.
Hey, WordTech. So I watched the season 4, episode 2 podcast of The Squanch, and I noticed how Jerry's dream was all about water, and it made me think about how it opposes how the aliens want to take all the water. What do you think the water might represent and how it affects both Jerry and the aliens?
Oh, gosh, I totally missed that. Because Alec and I, we were talking about how, all right, well, Jerry wants to deliver water because it's just simple, meaningful work that he can execute well. But what we didn't realize is that maybe that was implanted with him because he was afraid that the Monogatrons were going to steal all the water.
Or we actually got an email, and I might read it, that he now associates water with love. So like after hearing that, he feels like delivering water is like this elevated task now that they're mentally associated for him.
Mm. Okay. Nice, Anonymous. All right, let's go with this next one from Ben.
Hey, Wisecrack. This is Ben calling in about Rick and Morty, the old man in the seat. My read on the episode that I don't think you guys touched on in your analysis was that this episode to me really seems like three vignettes of different ways that human relationships build and like human interaction. You have Jerry being very codependent. You have Morty being kind of neglectful. You have Summer, who's kind of fleeting. You have Beth, who's overly protective. You have Rick, who's straight up abusive. And finally, you have the guy, the poop guy, I can't remember his name. And he seems to be the only person who's kind of well-adjusted in the entire grouping and is just willing to be somebody's friend. So it's showing that the entire Smith family has dysfunctional ways of building human connection. And it kind of shows each one of that in its own separate little bit by doing, you know, the A, B, and C plots. And I just thought that was a really cool way of kind of tying all three of those together thematically and not just actual plot. So anyway, those are my thoughts. Want to know what you guys think. Thanks.
Thank you, Ben. I think that was very interesting, and I definitely see it.
Yeah, I think I like that read a lot. And I like the idea of someone with like a sort of healthy attitude towards other humans being embodied by someone who'd share a toilet.
All right, we got one from Colton.
Hey, what's up, Wisecrack? This is Colton from Nebraska, first-time caller, long-time listener. I'm calling in to talk about Rick and Morty from the last episode for the Squanch podcast. So Jared and Alex spoke about in episode 4 that in the post-credit scene where Jerry was a water delivery guy, and Jared said he really didn't get it.
Mm.
But early in the episode, the Magnanotrons spoke about water being like one of the most valuable substances in the universe, and maybe this is Jerry thinking like, finally he has some sort of purpose in the wider range of the universe that he's like hauling around like the most valuable stuff, but to Earthlings it's just nothing, and it's finally given him some purpose. So thanks for listening, and thanks for everything you guys do. Have a good one. Bye.
That was definitely a big miss on our parts. Now we have two people that have corrected us. Thank you, Colton.
Yeah. And I think the quote is, love is infinite, but water, on the other hand, I forget what they say, but it's very scarce.
Yeah. All right, let's do one more from Jack.
Hey, Wisecrack. I'm calling into the Squanch. My name's Jack, and I wanted to give you my thoughts on the episode of Rick and Morty, The Old Man in the Seat. I felt like Beth was an uncharacteristically good mother and wife in this episode, and I wanted to hear you guys' thoughts on if this is more evidence that she took Rick's offer to be replaced by a clone at the end of season 3. I also thought that Rick seemed to be acting especially kind in this episode as well. I know he's shown mercy in the past, like in Look Who's Purging Now, where he chooses not to kill the village girl and instead help her overthrow the elite in her society. But I felt like his turn from wanting to murder the man who violated the sanctity of his toilet to sort of pranking him in a friendly kind of way was a little bit out of left field. Do you think this shows some sort of growth on Rick's part, or maybe my bloodlust for that character was prompted by my own, the importance of my bathroom time in my own life?
See,
I just want to hear you guys' thoughts. Have a great day. Bye.
Yeah, this is a true Rick and
Morty. See, you're totally not weird to go seek out abandoned bathrooms in your university. It's totally normal.
Right. all right, so let's do the first part about evidence that Beth is a clone. What do you guys think?
Absolutely 100,000% agree. Could not agree more. Next question.
I mean, I don't even agree or disagree. I don't know.
It's one of those things where I hope she's not a clone. That would kind of ruin it for me, because my favorite relationship in the show is Beth and Jerry. And it would suck if all of the progress that they've made over the last season of actually coming to love each other in some sense of the word, if all that ended up being bullshit because she's a clone, that would...
That's your own projection, man. How do you know that a clone... that's the whole point. A clone Beth would be Beth, basically. Interchangeable. It's not bullshit. You know,
well, then I guess
feelings too. Beth's feelings.
Well, then I guess it just doesn't matter then, right?
It's no different than Rick's consciousness going into a new body.
I guess
it
so.
It truly doesn't matter.
All right. Truly doesn't matter. All right. So then next question.
But I agree. Yes. 100,000%.
Next question. Was Rick nicer than usual?
I loved my favorite part of last episode was when he set off the shit bomb that farted up the room and then made a shit a middle finger. That was like so funny and in character and a great sight gag. So, yes, I like that he is just more vindictive and a just total asshole that will ruin your day as much as he possibly can, but you know, without killing you.
Well, but the plan was to kill him.
Exactly. But he didn't.
Right. And to Jack's point, because he's got a little bit of a heart. I think it's just that's what makes the episode more powerful, is to know that Rick does have a heart. It's just one that he has to kind of put to the side. He doesn't listen to his heart. He tries to silence it.
Yeah. And it's funny because it's like he has a heart with things that I guess you're supposed to traditionally have a heart about, because it's like he would have killed the guy, but then he found out that he had a dead wife. Right. And then that made him sympathize with him. Right.
I think it was what made him sympathize with him is that he found a kindred spirit in that they're both shy poopers.
Yeah, I think of the kindred spirit thing, and I think what's kind of interesting is that most people for Rick are kind of outside of the bounds of Rick caring. Like, everything to Rick is disposable, but this person is possibly seen as an equal. And it's not that, like, someone you see as an equal, you have to like them, but they're sort of, like, in a legal sense, they're afforded rights. This is definitely a stretch, but I'm just thinking about, there's this concept in Roman law called homo sacer, which is... a person who can be killed with impunity, but cannot be sacrificed in religious rituals. It both means accursed and sacred. The idea is just that it's like this person exists outside the bounds of the law. And I think like everyone exists like that for Rick, that they are completely outside of the bounds of caring, empathy, etc. But this person, by sort of proving that they are a kindred spirit, is able to at least... possibly get a little bit of Rick empathy.
Yeah, that's why I said this guy is almost like Dr. Wu status, and that he's one of the few people who's really been able to penetrate his emotions in some way.
Yeah.
Yeah.
All right, let's go into the mailbag. You can hit us up at squanch@wisecrack.co. Alec, what do we got?
Here's an email from Daniel that I picked just for you, Jared. Hi, guys. I was just catching up on the podcast. And what you said about why he, Tony, rejects heaven, as Zizek says, it's the most important lesson that psychoanalysis teaches us. We do not actually desire what we think that we desire. And since he thought that he desired a utopia of pooping, he was disappointed when he got it.
Well, then my question is, does it not work for anybody? It seemed to work very well for Jerry at the end, because at the last image we see is him gobbling it all up. But I appreciate the sentiment, definitely.
Yeah, I also appreciate the sentiment, but I think I disagree.
Yeah, because you would think that Rick would have tested this stuff and have known if it worked or not. It's not that, you know, this whole Lacanian thing of once you fulfill your desire, that's the second you don't want it anymore. That doesn't only apply to some people or exceptional people. That applies to everybody.
Yeah, I also don't think Rick would be reading Lacan. I know he's the smartest person ever, but I just am not really seeing it.
He's read every book, dude. They're all implanted, injected.
I feel like he would skip Lacan.
Yeah. All right. Here's an email from Dominic, who I think has emailed us before. Hey, Squanchers. I had a different interpretation on the love is abundant speech. I read that as referring to the many different types of love that exist. For example, familial love or the love between two friends, and how we humans neglect these forms of readily available love to chase after a narrow idea of a one soulmate romantic love. The idea is demonstrated in the two other subplots. In the Summer Beth plotline, Summer ignores her mother's love to chase after meaningless hollow relationships with her app-defined soulmates. She ignores the love that is so strong that her mother will do anything, even beat her up, to stop her throwing her life away. Or as Beth says, mother your fucking face out of your stupid asshole.
Yeah, this is why I like this episode. We've gotten so many different interpretations from this episode. It's a really good one.
Yeah. In Rick's plotline, Rick refuses to accept the potential love of a good friend because he's too afraid that the universe will just take it away, just like it has taken away every other thing in his life. Tony saw this and called Rick out on it. I think that's also the reason Tony refused to stay in the Globofen-induced heaven. He recognized it for what it was, a hollow imitation of real love and not the abundant real thing. Rick missed the abundant love that was readily available to him, the many people who came into his life and whom he refused to kill but also refused to let in, and as a result is a lonely, suicidal soul. Just wanted to share my thoughts on the episode. Keep up the great work.
Yeah, so as far as how the abundance speech contrasts with Beth and Jerry, which is kind of how I primarily read this, I actually think it's saying that we ought not think of love as infinitely abundant, at least because that's not what allows Beth to be comforted by Jerry at the end and comforted in the love that she has for her husband, because obviously there are other people like Ted Danson who would be much more fulfilling in a variety of ways, but rather it's kind of more about love being hard work that she ends up committing to. But in terms of the other things, like the way that our previous caller had described love as the kind of love that Tony feels for his dead wife, the kind of love that that Morty kind of shows to his dad, even though it's kind of a dysfunctional love, I do think we do see a variety and abundance of different kinds of love in the episode, and I think it's really smart for that reason.
Yeah.
All right, What's up next?
All right. Here is a good clarification email from Jesse. Hey, Wisecrack. I'm Jesse from Mississippi and was wondering what y'all thought about this. In the Old Man in the Sea episode, you mentioned when y'all are discussing the, Rick's cloning protocol in relation to his suicide attempts that you assumed he'd be in control of it. However, Rick destroyed his own clones at the end of Big Trouble in Little Sanchez, the Tiny Rick episode, even referencing his axe rampage when he first wakes up in the fascist dimension. Quote, I thought I axed this program. Get it? Axed?
Mm. Yeah.
It seemed as if even after destroying all of his own clones, other universes pull his consciousness in against his will, meaning he doesn't have the ability to just turn off if he really wanted to kill himself, making it even more depressing. What do you think?
Yeah, it's like the fucking Deadpool thing I was talking about, perhaps unnecessarily.
Perhaps unnecessarily. Here's a short one from Anthony. Hey, Squanchers, quick question. How did the guy, Tony, who used Rick's toilet get to the toilet in the first place? It seemed to me like the whole planet was empty of intelligent life. So maybe this guy was actually on Rick's level of intelligence, and further suggests the sadness Rick felt due to his death was due to losing someone he identifies with. Keep on squanching, Anthony.
That is a great question. Do we get any idea of what his job is? Because maybe if he worked for a travel agency or something, it would make more sense. But yeah, how does he just end up getting there roughly as fast as Rick did?
I hope he has the most inane bullshit job, but on the side is like a secret genius and he's just crushed under the system like we all currently
are. I mean, he's in like a cubicle office situation, right? Because Rick does take him to that conference room.
I hope he's got like a PhD in physics, but works as a telemarketer. I hope that's in my headcanon now.
Yeah.
Good question, though. It makes no sense.
I wish I had something better for you. But anyway, we're going to wrap it up. So as you guys may have heard, there's no new Rick and Morty next week, which means that we will be back in 2 weeks with the next episode of The Squanch. I want to thank my co-host, Ryan and Alec, for joining me. Where can we find you guys on the internet, Ryan?
I've been pumping out shorts on Ryan Shorts on YouTube and Facebook. And you can find me on the Funhouse channel sometimes too, editing and being on the videos. Love you, everybody.
And this whole podcast was a double cross because it was all...
That's right. This is a double cross.
It was Ryan's game show, masquerading as Funhouse, masquerading as Wisecrack.
Yeah, you're on a game show right now. Everyone gets ramen who's been on this game.
Of a bitch, I'm in.
And Alec.
I'm on Twitter at Wisecrack Alec. Come talk to me.
All right, cool. All right, we'll be back in 2 weeks. And as always... Wubba lubba dub dub! Peace.
Bye.
You son of a bitch, I'm in. I said alas.